Insights, tuned to yesterday, bringing you programs from radio's golden age. I'm your host, Mark Livonier, coming up in this hour, science fiction. Later on, From Quiet Please, from 1948. But first, a broadcast of X-1 called Protective Mimicry. First heard on NBC on October 3rd, 1956.
And now, X-1. Countdown for blast off. X-5, 4, 3, 2, X-1, fire. Far horizons of the unknown come transcribed tales of new dimensions in time and space. These are stories of the future, adventures in which you'll live in a million could-be years on a thousand maybe worlds. The National Broadcasting Company presents
X-1.
Tonight's story, Protective Mimicry, by Algis Budrys.
Frankly, I think I'll probably have to take my expense account clear up to the Central Galax Civil Service Board. My friends tell me to forget it. But take it from me, a rap in the credit book like this isn't easy to laugh off. Not on a grade 4 civil service pay scale. So I've made my beef out in quadruplicate and filed it. Usually, a special agent in United Galactic Federation's Department of the Treasury, Investigations Division, Currency Section, doesn't have much trouble with his swindle sheet. But this... well, this one's a corker. To understand, you gotta know how they make the stuff. The Ungallic Mint is in New Geneva on Canopus 3... I remember I went around with the 40 deci credit tour when I first joined the staff. The guide was a cute little brunette from one of the rim stars who was later fired following an annual pan-solstice office party. I didn't pay much attention to her spiel. She was dressed in the new Neo-Minoan style, but I got the general idea.
This is a demonstration machine, of course, but you will notice the indestructible fiber coming off that spool at the right. It goes into the slot in the machine there. Now, if you'll pass along, you see it goes between those two rollers through 6 or 7 chemical baths. No, I'm not sure what chemicals. That's restricted information. It's stamped, analyzed for flaws, dyed, and then run through this unit here. This is the most carefully guarded part of the process. The unit is removed from the plant each night and locked in the deep space vault on the satellite station directly overhead. After the strip emerges here, it is chopped into convenient lengths and carefully removed into armored cars. It is called money.
What does that secret unit do?
Well, that's a very good question. You see, the currency is non-defaceable, fireproof, immune to wear, weather, and water. But the most important thing is an electronic pattern impressed into the fiber by that secret pattern. You all know when you cash a bill, it is passed over an electronic plate that reads the pattern. If the serial number and the pattern match, well, but if they don't, well, first I'll put an ordinary credit note over the beeper. There. Perfectly good. Now, a simulated counterfeit bill without the electronic pattern. Well, now, that wouldn't fool anybody long, would it?
Could anybody duplicate that electronic pattern?
Well, that's a very good question. Only the government has the equipment to put that in. Your currency is safe and sound. Don't you worry about that. Are there any more questions?
Yeah. How about a drink after the tour?
Well, that... oh, that's a very good question.
Sure was. So was the answer. Well, getting back to money. The engraving, the chemical composition of the ink and the fiber would be tough enough to duplicate. But that electronic pattern snaps the clincher on it. That's why Chief Inspector Saxgard of my division looked sourly at me when I came into his office and spread a fistful of credit notes on his desk.
What's that?
What's it look like?
A handful of 50s. Why?
Put a couple of them over your beeper plate.
Okay. Well, they're perfectly okay. What's it all about?
Look at the serial numbers.
3456678M.
Look at the others.
3456. What? Let me see them.
Save your eyes. They're all the same. 14 50 credit notes with identical serial numbers.
That's impossible.
And every one of them goes over a beeper plate, quiet as a sophomore climbing into a dormitory window after hours.
Formosa, where did you get these?
They came into the New York clearinghouse from a branch on Deneb 11. The manager blew his top. He called us the minute he spotted them and sent them out to us.
How about the manager? Is he blabbing all over the Bankers Club about it?
I read the Un-Gallic Riot Act to him. He'll keep it under his hat.
Good. At least we won't have any financial panics for a while. Have you checked these through the lab?
Well, the ink and paper is government stock, and they match government beepers. The lab plates didn't squawk any more than yours did. Now, you could spend these anywhere as long as you only pass them one at a time.
Bumholzer, you know, since the beeper plate came in, we've been sitting on our tails in this department, building up our pensions.
No, I wouldn't say that.
Neither would I outside this office. But you know darn well nobody can expect to counterfeit a bill and get away with it. It's only because throughout the universe there's a certain percentage of people who will try anything once, and a corresponding percentage of purblind idiots who will accept anything with engraving on it as money that we're here at all. Now, I've seen cigar coupons and crayon sketches come into this office. I've seen premium offers from household magazines, jet bus transfers, where some people would try to pick a Yale lock with a quarter of a pound of butter. Now, the only reason any queer can pass is because some goggle-eyed nudnik neglects to use his beeper plate. But I worry. I worry. For 15 years, I've sat in this stinking office and waited for somebody to invent a matter duplicator.
Well, looks like you can stop worrying. Look at those bills. Identical down to the whiskey stain in the corner.
All right, Bumholzer. You call transportation and get out to Deneb 11 and find out if anybody in that neighborhood has a matter duplicator, or if he hasn't, what he has got.
I picked up the department shuttle to the satellite and made fair connections up to Deneb 11. It's a 4-day run on drive, and I get free fall 6, so I was glad to hit the port in Glub, which, so help me, is the name of the only city on the place. Deneb 11 is what we call in the department a mud ball. It's a jungle world with an atmosphere like a swatch of Harris Tweed. I was smoking a cigarette when I got off the shuttle, and the air I pulled in made the smoke taste like well-decayed leaf mold. I was wringing wet 2 minutes after I left the air-conditioned port. I noticed the local costume would get you arrested on any beach in the galaxy, but it didn't matter since there's nothing titillating about pasty skin dripping with weary perspiration. I checked in with the regional office and found the resident agent tinkering with his air conditioner.
Hi, Bumholzer. You know anything about the sealed power pack on this condenser?
Yeah, if you keep banging at it like that, you'll crack the seal on the atomic shielding and your posterity will thank you. Three heads at a time.
Oh, I guess I better not fool with it. Now take off your pants and pull up a chair.
I don't mind if I do. Is it always this humid?
Oh, no. In the hot season, it's worse. I'd send for a replacement part, but the fax line isn't too reliable. The last time I sent for a sealed unit, they shipped back an overage sea lion.
Yeah, I know. I was on Polar Station on Ganymede when my heater element broke down. I faxed for 3 feet of element, and they shipped me back 3 feet of elephants.
Yeah. Well, I suppose you're here about the queer bills, huh?
Yeah. Got any lines on it?
Well, my orders are to lay off and let the central office handle it. Be my guest.
Any ideas?
No. Where do you figure to start?
Well, this is the only city. I'll have to check it out. Have you got a list of authorized beeper plates?
Somewhere. Let's see here. Oh, look out!
Why?
There's a whittle fly on your arm.
Hey, how does a thing that size get through the filters?
Insects on Deneb are tricky. This one is a non-filterable virus in the larval stage. Then it blows up to this size. Carve his initials in your arm if he gets a good bite. That's why he's called a whittle fly.
The whittle fly was only one of the darlings that made the fair city of Glub a garden spot. They had one cute little tyke called the laboratory beetle, because when he bit you, he typed your blood and followed you around for days getting refills. I had one take a sample of me as I went out the door of the residency with a list of beeper plates, and he followed me from store to store while I checked every installation in the city. The little devil would step up to the bar every once and again to take another shot of my hemoglobin. I even tried ducking in a men's room as fast, but he'd be waiting for me when I came out. Well, I slogged through Glub for 3 days and then poured myself back into the residence office. Did he come in?
Who?
The laboratory beetle.
No, they usually hang around in the hall and wait. Sometimes when I've got a poker game going, you can see three or four of the little angels buzzing around outside waiting like chauffeurs outside the opera.
Wow.
They draw a blank?
Well, I found 7 defective beeper plates, but nobody remembers any queer bills being passed. You know, who checks serial numbers? They must have come in one at a time. And the clerks at the bank always were out to lunch and referred me to the next guy. You got any lotion for insect bites?
Yeah, desk drawer.
In a way, the beeper plates make it tougher. Nobody even looks at the bills anymore. Just throw them over the plate, and if no bells ring, it's okay.
Well, how about the other angle?
Matter duplicator? I checked invoices and purchase records. Nobody's been buying electronic parts that can't account for every tube. I thought I had something. One fellow bought 12 of those giant lithium cathode tubes, but it turned out his wife was having them wired as lamp bases. Well, I better be going. I hate to keep my little insect friend out there in suspense as to cocktail time.
You got another lead?
Yeah, I found a bar that makes a Tom Collins with real lemon juice instead of battery acid. I managed to duck my lab beetle in a revolving door. He went around twice and shot out into the street, so I settled down at a table at the bar and tried to make believe that I couldn't taste Den of 11 atmosphere in my Tom Collins. I was chewing on an ice cube when I looked up.
Mr. Baumholzer?
That's right.
I want to talk to you about money.
He was a terrestrial, but he'd been on Deneb a long time because he was wearing the native garment about the size of a 5-pound sugar sack. His hair, which was potato field gray, was arranged in the old-fashioned Presley style. You know, the ancient long sideburns, duck's tail in the rear that vice presidents wear in family-style banks. His ears had little bits of bone stuck in them, and his eyebrows wandered all over his face, and he stood about 6'8". And I waited him out, and presently he spoke up again.
You are the same, Mr. Baumholzer, who's been going around asking all those questions about duplicate ungallic notes?
That's right. Can I help you, Mr.
Munger, Duodecimus Munger.
Now, this bid's fair to be fascinating. I was under the impression that my mission here was just a wee bit on the secret side.
There are no secrets in Glub.
Now, won't you pull up a chair, Mr. Munger?
I'm afraid I haven't time.
Well, join me in a drink.
Are you really the Mr. Baumholzer that's working on this case for the Treasury Department?
Yeah, sure. Hey, you're not the fellow that's turning out these duplicates, are you?
Well, as a matter of fact, I am.
What?
And don't move. This is a Power 30 Mistral Coagulator I have.
Look out with that thing. You've got it pointed at my head.
Yes. I've got it set on high charge. It will fuse your brain solid.
Well, what else is new?
Now, Mr. Baumholzer, stay right behind that table.
Now, let's not make any rash decisions now.
Well, I can't very well see how I could let you live.
Oh, come on. Try. All right, now drop the gun.
I'm afraid we'll be collecting a crowd.
Give me that. Don't try to pick it up.
I won't. I had something completely different in mind.
Just like in those ancient legends the archaeologists keep digging up, the ones with the hard-boiled detective and the beautiful blonde, I felt the traditional roof fall in on the back of my head. As I went black, I remember thinking how odd it was that it was happening to me some 500 years after Spillane the Scrivener. I came to in the same archaic fashion with my head going around in a free orbit around my neck.
Baumholzer, are you all right?
I can't see. I'm blind. Everything's black.
Well, open your eyes.
Oh. Where is he?
Who?
The guy who slugged me. What am I doing back at your office?
Oh, some bartender brought you in. I thought you passed out from too much lemon juice.
It was a guy named Munger. Which way did he go?
Beats me. Munger? Tall feller in native dress?
Yeah.
Oh, well, you might as well forget about it.
Why?
Well, I can order a pickup on him next time he's in town. They'll sock him away in a psycho ward for a while. Forget it.
Look, I am not an old lady calling up complaining that the nasty delinquents are teasing my cats. That Munger's tied in with the queer.
Him?
He said he was the passer.
Well, that can't be. Munger.
You got a file on him?
Yeah. I get a number of complaints on him, so do the local cops. He's, well, I didn't want to make trouble. He's a very wealthy man.
I'll bet. What does he do?
Well, he's a merchant or something in a native village. Once or twice a year, he comes out and paints the town, but a counterfeiter?
I would like to talk to him again with the mistral in my hand.
He had a mistral? Well, that's a violation of a municipal ordinance. You're supposed to check him at the quarantine.
Look, I'm not investigating parking tickets and violations of the anti-noise laws. This is a counterfeiting case. Now, do you know where I can find him?
Well, he's probably gone back to his village.
Where's that?
Out in the jungle.
All right, get out your rubbers, friend. We're going out after him. Suppose you fill your bathtub full of mud, build a fire under it, turn on the shower, and crawl in and wallow a little. Do that, and you've got a fair idea of the Denebian jungle. I went out with Hall, the resident agent, and we started off.
Stick close, Baumholzer. Visibility is about 10 feet.
I'll eat everything I can see within 10 feet.
Ow! What happened?
I walked into a tree. Help me up out of the mud. Puddled on for a couple of hours. The rain was so thick I didn't see the trees until I bounced off of them and sat down in the warm mud. I reflected as I struggled to my feet what a terrible waste. In the beauty salons of Charles of the Ritz asteroid, ladies from all over the galaxy paid thousands of credits for hot mud baths to take the wrinkles out and make their skin smooth and caressable. And here was I getting a much more thorough treatment every time I sat down. They issue a lot of special equipment from department stores, and it all functioned perfectly. My neo-latex galoshes were fine, but stuck in the mud. My Minipower goggles and wipers kept my eyes clear, but they didn't keep me from crashing into every tree. My leak-proof sportsman's flashlight stayed dry as a bone, but powerful as it was, it couldn't light up more than 3 feet in the pelting rain. Paul, the resident, led the way, consulting a compass and a waterproof map, and finally we stopped, and I noticed that there wasn't any rain coming down on me.
It's a rain shelter. The natives build them.
Kind of them.
Well, they're on all the trails. If you go more than a day in the rain, you go punchy from water drumming on your hat.
I believe it.
Well, now, don't sit down. You'll sink in.
I don't know. Theoretically, a broader base should keep you from sinking like snowshoes.
Well, also increases the suction.
I'll stand. How far is Munger's village?
Well, either 2 miles or 22. I can't read the map very well.
Hey, wait a minute. Listen.
Well, that's the rain.
No. You hear that squelching? Somebody's coming.
Oh, yeah. From over there.
Natives?
Maybe.
There he comes.
Well, we've got first pick on the shelter. It's a native tradition. First come, first dry.
Yeah, somebody out there, all right.
Who's there? Who is it?
A friend of mine, Mr. Baumholzer.
All right, Munger. Where did you come from?
Don't move. I have several friends pointing long spears at your kidney.
Ole!
Shall we go, gentlemen, back to my village? I believe you were looking for it.
Munger was so intent on me that he didn't seem to notice as Hall sidled off into the darkness, and when he did, he set up a desperate cackle. He had a few of his fraternity brothers chase down the trail with spears waving wildly, but they came back murmuring some kind of a Choctaw, which seemed to carry the implication that Hall had gotten away like a big-bottomed turtle.
Well, Mr. Baumholzer, your companion's action has saved your life for a while.
Yeah, he'll bring back a platoon of Marines, and they'll reduce that village to a bullion cube.
We'll just have to hold you as a hostage in case help should arrive.
Thanks.
At any rate, shall we get back to the village?
He had about 10 natives with him, each one about 7 foot tall, with those big, flat feet that evolved on Deneb for walking in primordial ooze. They were dressed in the standard native loincloth with matching accessories, namely 10-foot spears. When, as we started out along the trail, I got a good look at Munger's loincloth, it was composed of tastefully arranged 1,000-credit notes. Well, by the time we got back to the village, the rain had stopped. The humidity, of course, was still 120%, and the only difference was that the moisture just loitered around rather than actually falling. There was some kind of a clam bake going on in the village. The natives were pounding a couple of drums, and as far as I could see, getting rapidly stinko on some kind of jungle juice that they passed around in huge gourds. They were leaping and dancing, and as far as I could tell, doing snappy sings and fancy patter as I sat on some kind of a low mushroom and tried to ignore the two spears that were pressed against my throat. It felt as if a nervous barber was trying to shave me with his razor tied on the end of a 10-foot pole. After a bit, Munger strode up to me with all the dignity of the lord of the jungle, and he waved the spears a foot away, pulled up a mushroom, and sat down.
Actually, you know, that wasn't a native rhythm at all. The original Danubian music is a kind of quiet, flute-like melody, something like Mozart.
That didn't sound very flute-like.
Yes, I know. One of the first terrestrial anthropologists out here to study the Danebs took recordings of their music. And then, to be polite, he played them in a few recordings that he'd made on an earlier field trip. Unfortunately, they were from that lost rocket colony on Ceres. Their music was a degenerate ancient form called, I believe, Roland Rock. The Danebs liked it. And they've been doing it ever since.
Well, what's the party?
They're propitiating the tree. I don't know why. It's never failed yet. But they're very conservative. They've got to go into this act every night before I can do my stuff. Lasts all night. Want a drink?
No, thanks.
Oh, I wish I had a fifth of something civilized. I've been drinking this native swamp water for much too long.
He was right. They kept it up all night, and I sat trying to figure out in which hut Munger kept his machinery to make those duplicate bills. Finally, the weak light that passes for dawn on Deneb came up, and the natives quit hollering.
Let's go, Bonhoeffer. I hate to keep a man in suspense. You're curious about those duplicate bills. Well, now you're going to find out how it's done.
Well, it's good of you to show me. I suppose your theory is that I'll never live to tell about it.
That's very sensible of you. I like a man who can face facts.
Across the mud square to the base of a tremendous tree, which I gathered was the guest of honor for last night's shivaree. I still couldn't see the connection, but I was willing to wait. The natives sat around in a deathly hush, and Munger and I stepped forward.
You notice? Nothing up my sleeves. As a matter of fact, no sleeves.
And not much arm, either.
Now, I take this 50-credit note. Care to examine it?
Oh, I've seen it, and 14 others like it.
Yes, I only use a 1,000-credit bill when the natives need new loincloths. These 50s are a lot easier to dispose of.
Oh, I don't know. I traced them to you.
But that was a mistake. One of my contacts got a little greedy, spent too many bills in one place. All right. Now, I used to have the natives make a loud noise, but I'll use your gun instead here. See, I take this bill, fold it, so, and so, and so, and there.
What are you making a paper plane for?
Just watch. I raise the note in one hand, I aim at the tree, and I fire your gun up in the air. Like this.
As he let fly with my gun, Munger sailed the paper airplane straight at the tree, and it sailed right into the foliage.
Now watch.
The bill came sailing back out of the leaves, and right behind it came another one. And then the air was filled with paper planes. Squadrons, wings, armadas of paper airplanes, each one made up of a folded 50-credit note. They sailed out over the whole village, and Munger set the natives to collecting them and bringing them back.
There you are. There'll be several thousands of them. Look, 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 look.
Genuine. Absolutely genuine. And I suppose they'd go over a beeper plate without a tinkle.
Startling, isn't it?
Protective mimicry.
Yes, precisely. You know, I discovered this tree 6 years ago. while I was attempting to evade the clutches of the law on a confidence rap. I swung an axe at it to blaze a trail, and 50 axes came bouncing back at me.
Well, I never heard of any plant developing mimicry to this extent. I know some plants and animals assume dangerous life forms as a camouflage, but this...
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm not a botanist. All I know is that you scare the tree with a loud noise. You throw something at it, and it duplicates what it thinks is the danger. Well, speaking of danger, it doesn't look as if your colleague is bringing any help. Oh, I'll miss your company. Interesting. You'll be shot with your own gun.
Now, look, Munger.
Don't wriggle. I hate a moving target. What is that?
Looks like the cops, Munger, at the edge of the village.
Baumholzer, where are you?
We outnumber them.
Ulaya!
I'll get you anyway.
No, no.
You can't run away from me. I'll shoot.
I broke for the other side of the square, and just as he shot at me, I tripped over a pot and went flying smack into the tree. Well, that's about it. Here we sit in the spaceport on Deneb 11, and I'm darned if I'll pay our transportation back until I hear that the office is going to okay my expense account. Munger? Oh, he's in jail at New Alcatraz. Once he missed his shot at me, it was all over. After I fell into the tree, he didn't stand a chance against us. That's right. Us. All 168 of me. Right, Ed?
You have just heard X-1. Tonight, by transcription, X-1 has brought you Protective Mimicry, written by Algis Burgess, and adapted for radio by Ernest Canoy. Featured in tonight's cast were Mandel Kramer, Terry Keane, Charles Penman, Dick Hamilton, and Wendell Holmes. This is Roger Tuttle. X-1 was directed by Daniel Sutter and is an NBC Radio Network production.
X-1 on Tuned to Yesterday, an NBC episode from the 3rd of October, 1956. This is an hour of science fiction on Tuned to Yesterday. I'm your host, Mark Levonier. Coming up next, a broadcast of Quiet Please, which was spearheaded by Willis Cooper, featuring his story, It Is Later Than You Think. Fans of the radio horror show Lights Out might recognize that line as it's part of the program's opening, a program which Willis Cooper created at 36 years old while a staffer at a Chicago radio station. He broke much ground with the series, from the writing to the grisly sound effects of weird creatures, choking, stabbing, murder, and more. And because of the impact the show had, Hollywood came calling to tap Willis Cooper for screenwriting jobs, which he took up for a couple of years. But within that time, Arch Obler, another radio producer, took over the Lights Out show and made it what many fans remember it to be today. During the time that Obler took over the show, he did have high regard for Willis Cooper, calling him the unsung pioneer of radio dramatic techniques. Be that as it may, old-time radio historians can't seem to decide whether the title of this next episode, which makes a clear reference to the Lights Out show, is an homage to Obler's work or a backhand. It's Quiet Please with the story It Is Later Than You Think, a Mutual Broadcasting System episode from August 2nd, 1948.
Directed by Willis Cooper, and which features Ernest Chappell. Quiet Please for tonight is called It Is Later Than You Think.
And so I venture to say that the Germans and the Japs are trembling in their boots at this moment for the word that Lindsay Bradley is on their trail. Lindsay, our loss is Uncle Sam's gain. Your fellow employees wish you success, adventure, and a bushel of medals. And in token of our high esteem for you, in remembrance of the happy hours we have spent with you in the plant, for we are all one big happy family, I present you with this 17-jewel, solid gold, imported wristwatch. May it ever remind you of your good friends here at this arsenal of democracy you are leaving to face our enemies in person. Speak! Speak!
Well, all I can say, fellow employees, fellas, and Mr. Throop, all I can say is, I thank you.
Well, yes, of course it's a beautiful watch, Lindsay. But for heaven's sake, this is your last night before you go to camp. And I do wish you could pay a little attention to me.
Oh, well, Verna, I'm sorry. I never had such a nice watch, though, and I get carried away. I'm sorry, honey, really.
Well, for goodness sake, act like it, then.
Huh? Act like what?
Act like you're sorry. Kiss me.
Oh. I should say so.
I am going to miss you, Lindsay.
Oh, heck, it isn't as if I was going overseas right away, honey. Well, my goodness, I'll probably be in the camp for quite a while to learn things. Heck, you could come and see me often.
Maybe I could get an apartment in the town where the camp is, and the sergeant or whoever it is would let you live at home and just go to the camp days.
Well, I don't know about that.
It'd be wonderful, Lindsay. You could come home for meals, and you could have a colonel in for dinner. It would be just like home.
Uh-huh.
First thing you do when you get to camp is find a nice apartment, about four rooms, maybe five, and I'll come right away, huh?
Well, I'll see, honey.
You don't seem to be very excited about it.
Well, I don't know how it'll be at camp. You know, I might not be able to find an apartment, and maybe I wouldn't be staying there long.
You don't want me to be with you.
Why, sure I do, Verna, but I...
You just want to leave me here all alone in this old place while you go off camping out and being in parades and having a wonderful time?
Well, I don't think it'll be like that, Verna. Francis Felton wrote last week from Camp Breckenridge, and he said he'd lost 13 pounds.
Well, he could stand it. Goodness, I just bet it's wonderful for the boys in camp, marching and having sham battles, and goodness, I wonder what you'll be doing this time tomorrow.
11 hours now, and I'll be arriving.
What are you doing with that watch?
Huh? I was just setting it ahead 11 hours.
All right. Get your heels together, all of you. Chin in, chest out. You're at attention.
My goodness gracious.
Quiet.
But I just...
And I said silence.
Could I ask a question, Lieutenant?
I'm a sergeant.
Could I ask a question, Sergeant? Please?
What?
Where am I?
You crazy, Mac?
Well, gee, honest, sir, I'm not sure.
Well, I'll just refresh your memory, bud. You're at Camp Dix, New Jersey. And you're a great, big, ugly, flat-footed private in the infantry, whether you like it or not.
Well, for heaven's sake... I said. How I got there, I will never know. One minute I was sitting on the Davenport with Verna right in my own living room in Highbridge, New Jersey, just for no reason, setting my watch 11 hours ahead, and then, bung, I'm alongside the railroad station in Camp Dix, and it's daylight, and this sergeant... Well, now, things don't happen like that. There's no such thing as magic. But, well, how? Tell me how. All right, you can't tell me, so I'll tell you. I'll tell you how I found it out. It was an hour later that they let us sit down a few minutes. And there was a man sitting alongside me, and he said, I have a good-looking watch, didn't I? So I told him how the boys at the plant gave it to me, and he admired it some more. And then he said, did I know my watch was an hour fast? So I said, is that so? And I turned it back and...
All right. Get your heels together, all of you. Chin in, chest out. You're at attention.
And I heard myself say, my goodness gracious.
Quiet.
But I just said...
And I said silence.
Could I ask a question, Lieutenant?
I am a sergeant.
Could I ask a question, Sergeant? Please? And by goodness, I went through that whole hour again. And I was so tired when we got back to the time and the place where the man said I had a good-looking watch. And I looked at that watch. I didn't say anything this time. So time went on the way it ought to go on, and they took us to eat. But I couldn't eat anything, because my stomach was full of great big butterflies. Finally, when I had a minute, I got to a phone booth, and I waited 45 minutes, and I got a call through to Highbridge to find out what Verna had to say about it, and Mrs. Houlihan from next door answered, and she said Verna was in bed with a high temperature. And what the dickens did I do to her on my last night at home? So I hung up. Sure, the watch. Whatever I said it at, that's what time it is. This could be a very handy thing. But I have to be careful. Say, where do you suppose they got that watch? It's really... And then I happened to think of something. My gosh, what would happen if that watch ran down someday if I forgot to wind it and it stopped? Would time stop? Wow. Well, I'm not going to try to find out. You know, this sergeant, he wasn't such a bad fellow at that. I was sitting on my bunk one night after supper. There wasn't anybody else in the barracks, and he walked in. I said, hi, Sergeant.
What's with you, Bradley?
Oh, I'm just tired.
Ain't you going to the movies?
No, they ran that picture in Highbridge 2 months ago.
Cigarette?
Thanks. Are you going?
I feel kind of low.
Oh, that's so?
Yeah. Got a dear John.
Which?
Letter from my girlfriend.
Oh?
Hey, you know. Dear John, I don't know how to tell you, but I have fallen in love with another guy, and you and I will always be good friends.
Oh.
Yeah.
Great.
So never get married, kid.
I am married.
Oh, excuse me. You happy?
Well, oh, sure. Sure. Sure, sure.
Great.
We've been married 4 years.
Miss her, huh?
You bet. This is a kind of vacation, though. You know. She said she might come down here to live, near the camp.
You like that?
Well...
What you monkeying with that watch?
Huh? I was just thinking of an experiment.
What kind of experiment?
Oh, nothing. There's nothing.
Huh. Want a beer? Walk over to the PX.
So... We walked over to the PX and we had a beer and then we had another and me and my big mouth, beer always makes me talkative. Told him I'd prove it to him.
How will you prove it to me?
Well, how soon will the movie be out and the fellas come back to the barracks?
An hour.
Okay. Watch.
What are you doing?
Sitting at ahead an hour.
Look, why don't you guys shut up and go to sleep?
Turn it
back!
Turn it back! Okay, Sergeant.
Brother.
Yeah. See, it works.
See, all appeared just out of nothing.
I've been using it.
Yeah? How?
I've been setting it ahead every day for a while.
What for?
See if my wife is going to arrive.
Huh? Wife?
Well, I'd like to have some warning, see?
Oh, so you can hit me for a pass.
Either that, Sergeant, or so's I can go AWOL. No, Verna's all right. We get along all right, but... Well, heck, she demands. I mean, I never got out before I was drafted, and... Well, darn it, I kind of like being my own boss. That is, as far as the Army had let you, you know what I mean? Yeah, I love Vern all right, but I knew what it'd be once she got settled in an apartment here in town. Heck, Highbridge isn't far away. I could get a pass once in a while, but here in town... No, I figured that was too close. Yeah, I feel a lot different about it now, but this was quite a while ago, see? 1944, and I'd only been away from her a few months. You know what I mean? Okay. So she snuck up on me after all. I forgot one night to set my watch ahead, and first thing the next morning, I got the word that she was here.
So I talked to the sergeant out of Talkville out of a pass. We kidded a little. I went to town to meet her. It was kind of nice. But, gosh, I couldn't get a word in edgeways.
Lindsay, you're so thin.
Well, I've been...
I know you. You just won't talk up to these sergeants and majors and people. Just let them walk all over you. You wait till I see somebody in authority.
Oh, now, Verna, you can't...
You've been drinking. I'll bet you've been drinking. Well, I'll put a stop to that. When we get an apartment here in town, you can have ginger ale at home. And I'll make brownies, and you can have some of the boys over once in a while.
Verna.
What?
Verna, do you love me?
Oh, you silly child. Of course I do. Here, give me a kiss. Now wipe off that lipstick. Are you going to take me out to the camp? I'm just dying to see it.
Well, I thought maybe we'd stay in town.
Now, Lindsay, I'm not going to sit around in this dismal town all day and all night when there's all sorts of interesting things going on out where you're camping. I came down here to enjoy myself, and that's what we're going to do no matter what you...
So that's the way it was. Yakety-yakety all the time, and I got awful tired of it all of a sudden. You know, it used to be I could kind of shut my ears to the yakety-yakety, but I seemed to have lost the trick somehow, and so then I thought, gosh, I'm going to see how long this is going to go on. So I turned my back, and I moved the hands of my watch ahead, and I'd got it 10 hours ahead, and I heard a kind of sigh or something. And I turned around, and you know what? There was this sergeant kissing my wife just as big as you please. Well, I grabbed his arm, and I tried to yank him away, but it was just like I wasn't there. And Verna spoke to him, and it didn't sound like the yakety-yakety she used on me.
Oh, Sergeant Kilroy, you're so impulsive.
And then I remembered that what I was seeing was 10 hours away, and I quick spun the hands of my watch back again, and well, doggone it, I went too far back.
Lindsay, you're so thin.
And that was where I came in, and I had to go through all of it again. But doing the repeat on the kisses wasn't so bad. Till I remembered the way she was going to talk to Sergeant Kilroy about 10 hours from now. Well, sir, about 5 o'clock he showed up and he told me I had to go back to camp. How do you like that? He could stay in town, he said, and he'd be glad to show my wife around and keep her entertained whilst I was away, my pal. And I crossed him up all right. I waited a couple hours after I got back to camp, and then I just set the watch ahead. And it's morning, and the whole company, including Sergeant Kilroy, is turning out for reveille. Well, she stayed there. She got an apartment such as it was. I got a lot of passes. I took the sergeant in with me every once in a while, and everything was as nice as pie. I didn't do much with the watch because I was scared of it. I took awful good care it was wound all the time. I tried once to see if I could turn it ahead farther than 12 hours, but I couldn't. When the hands got the 12 hours ahead, everything just clicked right back. Well, you see, 12 hours, the hands just come right back to where they were when you started. Well, anyway, half a day's enough for me. Heck, it's too much. Think it ain't? Yeah, there come a day. There always comes a day. A big bunch of us got pulled out early in the morning with our A and B bags and everything out of the kitchen stove hung onto us. We're off to the races. Only Sergeant Kilroy, he's permanent detail. He stays in camp. Great deal. Well, I'm smart. I get myself lost in the dark. And I beat it for a taxi, and I haul down to town our apartment. No, Verna doesn't know I'm leaving. I don't know where I'm going, and... No, I'm not trying to desert. I want to find out something. I get in the apartment, and Verna doesn't wake up. And she looks awful cute asleep. But I turn the hands of my watch ahead 3 hours. Nothing happened. Except the bed was all of a sudden empty, and I could hear Verna out in the other room, and of course it was full daylight now. So I heave a big sigh of relief. Everything's all right. And then...
Who is it? Who is it?
Kilroy's here, darling.
I thought what to do, and then, well, just as Vern unlocked the door, I got it. I set my watch back where it belonged, and it was early dark morning again, and she was asleep there in the bed, smiling, and I got out of the apartment. I'll fix that, I said to myself. I'll beat it back to camp, and I'll knock that Kilroy's head off, and a big MP stepped up in front of me.
Hey. Take it easy, Mac. Where are you going with that equipment?
Huh? I missed the train, huh?
Oh, you missed the train, huh?
Yeah, I...
That's fine, Mac. Listen, the train ain't left yet, Mac.
Oh?
It ain't due to leave for 20 minutes yet, Mac. So I'll tell you what I'm gonna do. Just get in the Jeep here with me, Mac. I'll deliver you special. Right to the steps of the car. Okay, Mac?
And so I started my trip overseas handcuffed to an MP. And there wasn't any kidding about it. I was on that train but good. And all the jumping up and down in the world wasn't going to do me any good. Because in an hour and a half, I was sitting on a bunk about a foot above sea level in the hold of a great big transport, and the ship was aiming for Africa as fast as they could turn over the propeller. Me and my fancy watch, I wish I'd never seen it. But what can a guy do? I throw it away. What'll happen? It'll stop him. Well, all right, maybe time won't stop, but you see what's happened before. Me, I won't take chances. So, well, it turned out it was a good thing I hung on to it. Because I'm in a hole a few weeks later with another guy in a bazooka, and Mr. Rommel's tanks are doing all right, and I'm scared. This fella, Red Felbinger, his name was, he's my loader, and we're popping away at Krauts whenever we can get a beat on one, and then there's a kind of lull, and we don't see anybody, so we light up a smoke. Red leans his arms up on the edge of the hole and looks out.
Looks like they blowed the whistle, Lindsay.
Huh? What you mean?
I don't see anybody anyplace.
Let me see. And that was the end of Red Felbinger. And it was pretty near the end of me, except for the watch. All the German tanks in the world were heading right straight for me and blazing away like the 4th of July. Only it wasn't no celebration. And the air was thick with hunks of iron, and I leaned down to pick up my bazooka, and then the thought come to me. I reached for my watch. 2 hours I'll set it back, I thought. And I did, and all the tanks and everything disappeared. So I climbed out of the hole and started away from there. And all I remember was... And everything went black and red and green, and I'm dead. I won't try to tell you about all the trouble I had with my arm, how I got sent back to the States, spent the next 4 years in the hospital. Verna? Sure, I saw Verna. I saw her a lot. She used to come and see me all the time. She was different. Seemed like all I'd been through had kind of changed her. She felt so sorry for me. Gosh, I got the feeling sorry for myself. You know how it is? Well, it was a long time, those years, with all I had to do to my neck and my arm. Once in a while, I'd think about Sergeant Kilroy. But, gosh, Verna was so different now. I knew everything was okay, so... Well, I forgot it. Funny thing was, though, I couldn't turn the watch up to where it belonged all that time. I tried. The nurses tried. The doctors... I couldn't do it. There was no soap. And all this time I got nervous and irritable. I used to have, delusions. One day last month, it was the first day I had my artificial arm. I woke up kind of dopey. I thought I'd seen somebody leaving my room at Walter Reed. I sort of heard the nurse talking to a guy in civilian clothes that looked kind of familiar. And I thought I heard him answer.
Oh, no. Just tell him Kilroy was here.
Tell Verna, but the new arm and everything, I forgot. So I got out last week. It was kind of fun. I went back to High Bridge. Verna fixed up her old place swell, and well, she was special nice to me. I pretty near felt I could afford to lose that arm to make that difference in Verna. She was all right. Only she kept kidding me about the way I fiddled with my watch. I couldn't tell her I was trying to get it set back to where it belonged. There was 2 hours worth of difference in that watch. I guess I got into the habit when I felt so lousy, always twiddling at it, you know, that... Oh, there's somebody at the door. Verna's downtown getting her hair fixed. I wonder who it is.
Yes. Hi, Lindsay.
Kilroy!
Mind if I come in a minute, Kid?
Why, sure. Sure, Kilroy.
Thank you.
Glad to see you. Gee, Vern will be glad to see you, too. Sit down.
Much obliged. Well, I see you still got the trick watch.
Yeah, still got it. How you been?
What are you fiddling with the watch for, Lindsay?
It got stuck.
Stuck?
Yeah, I keep fooling with it. Well, tell me where you've been since you got out.
I wish you'd stop fooling with that watch.
Oh, I'm sorry. Hey! By golly, I got it. I got it! I'll just set it ahead 2 hours to make...
About time. Where you been? All right, I'll meet you there.
What?
Good Lord, yes. Certainly I did.
What?
Well, how would you like to sit around in a room for 2 hours with a guy you just shot?
Huh?
Quiet, please. On Tuned to Yesterday from the 2nd of August, 1948 on the Mutual Broadcasting System. Wrapping up this hour of science fiction on Tuned to Yesterday. Be sure to be with us next time for more great programs from radio's past. Until our next hour together, I'm Mark Livonier. It's been a pleasure.